Blog Talk Radio.
Hello out there. My name is Sam Maxwell, and welcome to the Bedford and Sullivan podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the research process of the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series I am developing. And before we get into old-time baseball, Brooklyn Dodgers, we're going to get into a little bit modern baseball at the beginning and bringing on the Branch Rickey biography, Lee Loewenfish. And though he has written about Branch Rickey, he is obviously very into baseball in general. Lee, thank you very much for being on again. Always good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Sam. You know, at the end of September, and we have an extra game today with the Rays and the Rangers. And
exactly.
And I'm following the Rays closely because the manager, Joe Maddon, was a big fan of Branch Rickey. He grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, and that organization has developed a farm system that Rickey would be proud of. So, you know, the great thing about our love of baseball from the Brooklyn Dodgers to today is that past and present combine in a way that a lot of things in America don't, and that's one of my loves for the game.
That's a great point that you make. Even looking at other sports, even I think basketball is really the only thing that comes to that can compare when it comes to the ghosts constantly haunting. Basketball's gotten, because of just the latter part of the 20th century, basketball is really the only thing that can really compete. But with baseball, I mean, Keeler is following these guys constantly, even if they don't know that name necessarily, a lot of the players, you know, that's the kind of history that baseball has in this country.
I know, and if you look at Dustin Pedroia of the Red Sox, who's only 5'9", I mean, and Sam Fold, who is not the great player that Pedroia is for the Rays, but he's another little guy who can run and play some defense, although he almost made a crippling error for the Rays this weekend. See, that's what's so great about this game. It can change on a dime, but it rewards you if you follow the whole season as well.
Well, being very into the Rays right now, what is your opinion of this new wild card game? I mean, we almost had a chance for a three-way tie when it comes to two spots in terms of the wild card. So what is your opinion of this new wave of baseball?
I give it mixed reviews. I mean, if I had the magic wand, and Sam, as you get older and more influential, maybe you can help develop this magic wand for me and for the good of baseball, I would shorten the season to 154 games, maybe even 150. I'm not sure I like the idea that a team plays 162 games now, and then in one game they all go home. But there's no doubt there's drama to it. But I really think the season stretches much too long, and people are talking about maybe adding day-night doubleheaders and increasing rosters for those doubleheaders, which indeed has happened. You know, I mean, we're almost in a golden age now with the players and the owners trying to do what's good for the game and not just what's good for your individual team. So I think that the wild card is exciting. There's no doubt about it, but the season goes much too long, and I would really hope that would be one of my first moves, would be to make the schedule 154 games at the most.
Well, I have two things to counter with that, because you mentioned something about the owners and the players. You're absolutely right. Even though they're obviously making more money than they've ever made, there's an understanding that they have to work together, and it's something that they didn't see at the beginning of baseball. They didn't get it. They just saw it as cattle. They just saw the players as cattle. But in terms of, number one, you already see I think on the doubleheaders now, you can have one extra roster spot for free, basically. You don't have to send anybody down, just add a 26th man. So what you're talking about is starting to come to fruition. And but in terms of the shorter schedule, I agree with you on that. but I don't think it's going to happen for money purposes. And though the players and the owners are working together better than they've ever worked at the same time, you cancel eight games, if somebody's finishing at home or if somebody's, you know, obviously if you cancel eight games, I'm sure they're going to split it up where four games, basically you lose four games at the box office. I don't think owners are going to go for that.
Well, I don't think TV is going to go for it because, I am intrigued that at the numbers I see in the newspapers of the crowds at the end of the season, that even in towns that have had pretty bad seasons, there seems to be a lot of good crowds the last weekend because it's now Fan Appreciation Week, and they're giving away a lot of things. And I think the Orioles that had a plus year, but certainly not the year that they had last year, so they're going home right now. But they had their players mingling with the fans, you know, serving drinks, greeting them at the door, and I think most teams did have that. So that's another reason for why the schedule will probably stay the way it is. But I do think in terms of weather and just the length of the season, you already had some awful weather for the best and most important games of the year, and you can't change the calendar, you know, as much as you would like. I mean, bad weather is going to happen at the end of October right. into November. So, you know, the interesting thing to segue back to Branch Rickey is that, you know, at the end of his life, he was pushing for a third league, the Continental League, which was probably, if the time had been right, would have been the better solution to what we have now. That would have been a third eight-team league that had cities, all of which, with the exception of Buffalo, are now in the major leagues. But he was too old to pull it off, and there was too much opposition from the established leagues, and that's why it didn't happen. But to segue back to him, he was such an innovator and yet such a essentially conservative man. He piqued my interest, and that's why I wrote what turned out to be a big book about a big man.
Yeah, exactly. And it would be very, very interesting to see what Branch Rickey thinks about current baseball, and I'm sure he'd be pleased, and I'm sure he wouldn't be pleased. I'm sure he'd have a lot of different things to try to counter whatever's going on. Let's segue back. No matter how much I'm very excited about playoff baseball right now, my team's not in there, and I can only kind of live the glory of the olden times in attempting to make this into a television show. So with Branch Rickey and his transition from St. Louis, for all of those who out there who know Branch Rickey as the man who brought Jackie Robinson to baseball through the Brooklyn Dodgers, do know that Branch Rickey innovated a lot of stuff before that. And before he was in Brooklyn, he was in St. Louis. Now, obviously, you know a lot about that. So tell me about the transition from St. Louis to Brooklyn for Branch Rickey. And when did his name really start coming up in discussion for taking over for Larry McPhail, who ended up dropping out to join the Army again?
Well, Sam, he actually almost came to Brooklyn a few years earlier because the Dodgers, as you well know, were in bankruptcy. The Brooklyn Trust Bank kept it afloat, and the Dodgers had all those warring heirs of the late Charles Evers and the late McKeever, who owned part of the team. And so Branch almost came in the mid-30s, but at that time he was on good terms with his owner, Sam Braden, who, by the way, was also from New York, was from Greenwich Village, the poor part of Greenwich Village. Braden wouldn't let him come, but by 1942, Rickey knew that he was going to have to leave the Cardinals because Braden was retired, was wealthy, and he didn't want to pay Branch Rickey what he was paying him, because Rickey was the highest paid person in baseball when you added the salary he got and the bonus he got for every deal he made of the minor and the major league players.
Yeah, that exactly. It's pretty crazy that he certainly was an innovator when it came to the business side of baseball. Even though, you know, when it comes to his relationship with Walter O'Malley, Walter O'Malley was even more on that side of the business of baseball. Can you paint me a picture as much as possible, as many details as we know, as to the phone call that was made to ask Branch Rickey to come to Brooklyn?
Well, it's it was at least 2 years in the making. Because he knew from 1940 on that he was not coming back to St. Louis when his contract ran out. And the Cardinals hadn't won a pennant since the Gas House Gang and in the World Series in 1934, but they were developing the great farm system that by 1942, which turned out to be Rickey's last year in St. Louis, not only beat the Dodgers in a pennant race that the great Tommy Holmes sports writer said was almost a pennant race that went on from June, because these two teams would wind up winning over 100 games each. Mm-hmm. And they not only beat the Dodgers, but they beat the Yankees in the World Series, the last four games in a row, a five-game World Series. So McLaughlin and the owners of the Dodgers were getting a little fed up with what McPhail's spending habits. As you probably know, Sam, the last straw was when he paid $100,000 for a player who did not turn out to be much, and McPhail went into the army again like he had done in the first World War, but he probably, if the war hadn't occurred, he probably would have been out. So they saw in Rickey a man who could build a great farm system and would not spend as much money, because, you know, Rickey was frugal. Jimmy Powers in the Daily News would pretty soon after Rickey comes to Brooklyn call him El Cheapo, and that became in the minds of so many people, the players and fans, the thing that stuck in your mind about Rickey. But to the owners of the Dodgers and to many of the players, he was an inspirational leader, and he certainly knew talent. So to answer your question, the phone call was starting certainly no later than 1942, and they were beginning to think about it in 1941 as well.
Okay, that is very interesting when it comes to the transition. And I'm thinking about the war years when I hear that, and I hear about the farm system, and it jumps to me that Branch Rickey was the perfect person to start rebuilding, if you will. Even though Larry McPhail did a lot of work, all those players were in the war at the time, the majority of the players.
And you know what's fascinating? You know, McPhail and Rickey were at one time on the same side. I mean, Rickey brought McPhail into baseball to be the general manager and the president of the Columbus team in Ohio during the Depression. And McPhail was a born promoter. In some ways, he was Bill Veeck before Bill Veeck, because he didn't bring a midget, but he spruced up the ballpark. He had fashion shows before games, and he did that wherever he went. Hired Babe Ruth as a coach for Brooklyn, dressed up the ushers. But when he became Rickey recommended him to Brooklyn after he took a leave of absence from Cincinnati because he was an alcoholic, and when he was in an alcoholic frenzy, you didn't want to be around him, so it's almost an operatic relationship between Ricky and McPhail and the other man, you know, Leo Durocher, who I was so pleased to see had an important role in the movie 42, because, you know, Leo Durocher, Ricky had so many problems with Durocher. Said about him, he had the infinite capacity to take a bad situation and make it worse. But he was a great manager, and Ricky knew that, you know. So that triangle between Ricky and McPhail and Durocher is almost operatic, and it's so much to the story of how Ricky replaced McPhail in Brooklyn and was not as popular a person, because McPhail, you know, I mean, fans, as long as the team won, the fans loved an owner who punched people, right? But, you know,
yeah,
Ricky,
right.
You know, but Branch Rickey was, you know, pontificated. You know, one of the great lines I ever read in my research was a Brooklyn fan heard him speak and said, "He's a man of many faucets all running at once." So he did, but in the popular mind, he could be easily branded as El Cheapo. But without him, of course, you not only don't have the great Brooklyn farm system that developed people from all over the country, starting as teenagers, you know, Hodges and Rex Barney and Duke Snyder, but of course you have the breaking of the color line that Ricky knew could only happen in Brooklyn, or certainly knew it could not happen in St. Louis.
Right, and what's interesting about that, and just a brief tangent, is that you hear Curt Flood talking about what he had to deal with, and you hear him talking about how Bush, I forget his first name, but the owner Bush, in the early 60s, had no idea that Curt Flood wasn't staying in the hotels, and this is the 60s, so...
Right.
You know,
and to the credit of Bush and Bill White, who was one of the team leaders of the Cardinals, they did buy a hotel in St. Petersburg where the Cardinals could all stay, and that proved an incredible asset to those teams that won the World Series in 64 and 67. You know, so
yeah.
These are great themes, and I'm glad you're aware of them, and I hope you know I can elucidate some of the finer points without losing the big thread, which was that, you know, without Ricky and Robinson, this would have been delayed a long time.
Right. And you think about the timeline of racial. Of what happened in the 50s in terms of how am I Little Rock? I blanked on the school for a second, but you think about Little Rock, you think about everything that happened with the March in Washington, the fire hoses in the 60s. I mean, this was still, you know, everything that happened in terms of actual policy really. Only, you know, happened like 15 to 20 years after Jackie Robinson came to baseball, which is one of the reasons why I believe Jackie Robinson Day on April 15th, which is now Tax Day, and I think you'd probably have to adjust Tax Day to have a national holiday, you know, and I'd be fine, obviously, paying taxes 2 days later on April 17th
yeah.
to celebrate Jackie Robinson outside of baseball, which is what I think should happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Martin Luther King always told Ricky Robinson, Roy Campanella, Newcomb that his job was made easier. His very tough job, obviously, was made easier because there was the example. There was the example
right.
that black and white could play together in a common cause. And that's why it's always good to rehash these stories.
Now, speaking of which, though, you mentioned in the book how some black leaders viewed Branch Rickey kind of not along the lines of as a prophet, as somebody who led them to the promised land, but more so as somebody who took advantage of the situation, of the opportunity. Can you get into that a little bit? Expand on that idea.
Well, in the aftermath, you know, in the Black Power movement of the 1960s and later, I mean, Ricky was seen, you know, by some of them as just, you know, a man who was in this for the money. And, you know, the line was, Jackie's nimble, Jackie's quick, Jackie makes the turnstiles, you know, click.
Right.
But, you know, at the time, you know, Branch Rickey had tremendous support from the black middle class, because they did see it as an important breakthrough. And, you know, one of the important stories is about when Rickey, right before Jackie Robinson started spring training for Montreal, but with the hope of making the Dodgers in 1947, Rickey gathered 30 middle-class black ministers, lawyers, doctors, and basically read them a riot act at the Carlton Y in Brooklyn, in downtown Brooklyn, saying that the biggest problem that Robinson will face is too much adulation from the black people. And it'll give him a spelled head. And, of course, Rickey was always thinking of what the reaction would be of the white players, because he was sensitive. Some people might say excessively sensitive, but it was who Rickey was, coming from a very white supremacist part of southern Ohio that still had an anti-slavery history. And so Rickey was very afraid that the white players would resent a black player with a swelled head. And the ministers at first were shocked, but then they understood what, you know, Rickey was saying, and they put up these signs, "Don't spoil Jackie's chances." And they kept the in check some of the rowdy and maybe too racially proud behavior at the ballparks. Now, years later, decades later, a whole generation of historians and activists have poo-pooed Rickey for the way he behaved like this. But at the time, he had support of the black middle class for what he did, and given what he was, an innovative but conservative individual, I think he handled things quite well.
I agree, and he didn't. You know, for one thing, one of the things I loved about the movie 42 was the fact that they didn't hide that idea of Branch Rickey. One of the things he, you know, in that first scene, that first crucial scene, he says, you know, money's all green. Money has one color, it's green. And you know, even if that was a big reason why, at the same time, everybody else in baseball loved money. You know, who doesn't, who really, let's be honest here, who doesn't love money? And unfortunately, the way the world works, we need money. You need money to function as a regular human being. And I find it endearing that he didn't hide behind that. And even though he understood the money-making potential of bringing a black player into the major leagues, at the same time, you know, other owners didn't do it because of their racism.
Yeah, and they were afraid of the reaction of the white players, you know, and that's where, you know, Rickey was believed in confronting a problem head on, and he also believed in challenging the, you know, the reasoning capabilities of people, including a lot of ball players who didn't come from particularly educated backgrounds. I mean, Rickey in his office had this sign that I found out in my research came from a evangelist and a geologist of the late 19th century, Henry Drummond, a Scotsman. And it said, "He who will not reason is a bigot. He who cannot reason is a fool. He who dares not reason is a slave. And in a lot of ways, he confronted players and colleagues who said this would blow up and there'd be, you know, race riots and everything. And where I thought the movie was good for a popular movie. I mean, I thought Harrison Ford really embodied that angry and yet moral side of Ricky, and Chadwick Boseman portrayed Robinson as equally angry and not inclined to take crap from, you know, from bigots, you know. So,
right.
You know, I thought the film worked well, although it's only as good a film as the kind of discussion one has afterwards, you know, because there's a lot left out of the movie, and it's almost.
Well, you only have 2 hours. You only have 2 hours to present the 1 year that they're trying. And I appreciated that they decided to stick to that timeline because.
Right.
You know, like looking at what I'm trying to do, basically the entire third season is going to be about Jackie Robinson. It's going to be about, introducing the integration in terms of the timeline that I'm trying to present. And that'll explore a lot more than they were able to in 2 hours. But I liked that they didn't try to just do a biopic about his entire baseball career. They focused on the most important thing in telling the story at the beginning, in presenting it finally to, because that's one of the things. Like, I have certain filmmaking pet peeves regarding it, but that didn't take away from my enjoyment of the movie, and it didn't take away from how much I believe the movie to be a very important. Because for one thing, had they screwed it up, I wouldn't find it to be as important, but at the same time, like, because of how important of a subject it is a classic.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is a story that people, some of the Jewish historians and myself included, to say it's like the Passover story, you know, that needs to be told over and over again. The sad thing is that there's so much ignorance and amnesia in the country that a lot of young people seeing that film didn't realize what segregation was like, you know.
Right.
And the film doesn't spare the audience. I mean, the opening scenes are riveting, you know, about what it was like traveling in the South. And how Robinson was not inclined, you know, to take guff and taking that gas pump out of the station if they can't use the bathroom is really one of the memorable early scenes in that film.
Yeah, it is, and as a Met fan, especially, I loved the Ed Charles angle. That was really, really awesome to me that the filmmakers included that, and it made it more endearing to me, you know, because I have so many little details that I give it crap for, if you will, when it comes to actually editing and putting the movie together, and I find certain Hollywood quirks that in the modern day I feel as if they don't trust the audience to get certain things, and they try to push them forward emotionally, but that's all, you know. I don't let that sour how much I appreciated the presentation of the whole thing.
Right.
But I don't want to get too much into the critique of that. I want to because we don't have too much time left, but I want to get into the Walter O'Malley angle of Branch Rickey's career in Brooklyn. And so Walter O'Malley, I believe he. You know, I'm early on in my timeline, so I'm still kind of at the late 30s. But I know that Branch Rickey, Walter O'Malley, came aboard in terms of ownership or a piece of the pie in 1942. So Branch Rickey comes along right after that. Talk about how their relationship formed. How did it eventually evolved to the point that Branch Rickey ended up leaving?
Well, O'Malley was the lawyer for the Brooklyn Trust Bank, and he was very close to McLaughlin, who ran the bank and had been one of those important men behind the scenes in New York City. He had been a former police commissioner, McLaughlin, and it was known as James V. McLaughlin, sometimes George V. McLaughlin, sometimes known as George the Fifth. And O'Malley, from the early on, saw that the Dodgers could be a very profitable operation, and he signed off on the scouting secretly of black players. And he had designs early on running the team. I mean, he had studied architecture, you know, graduated University of Pennsylvania. His father had been a big commissioner of markets in New York, so he was a big city mover and shaker. And he saw the Dodgers as a very profitable enterprise. Rickey saw it as profitable, but still basically a baseball system and organization with hundreds of players in the minor leagues, and they were bound to clash. And the existence of John Lawrence Smith, who was the head of the Pfizer chemical company, kept the O'Malley and Rickey coming confrontation under control. Smith liked Rickey. The only thing he didn't like about Rickey was that Rickey got involved in supporting Brooklyn Dodger football that cost a lot of money to the organization. But he supported the integration. He supported the farm system. But he also had cancer, and he was dying in the late 1940s. And when he died during the All-Star break in 1950, that was the beginning of the end. That was actually the end game for Rickey, because Rickey wanted his contract extended from, you know, the first success of the Robinson team from 47 on. But the rest of the board wouldn't do it. O'Malley was getting more power on the board, and he had gotten the power of attorney from John L. Smith's widow, and that was the last straw. And Rickey was forced out, and he went to Pittsburgh, and it was quite a executive power play in the last months of 1950. Rickey, the deal was that the three partners, O'Malley, Rickey, and John L. Smith, each had a third of the team. Smith offered loans to O'Malley so he could legally have his third. Rickey took out a lot of insurance loans to take care of his third. The deal was that when one of the three wanted to get out, they had to offer his share to the other. So when O'Malley tells Rickey, you know, you're not going to be president anymore, he offers Rickey only what he paid for it in 1945, which was $333,000. By then, the team, the most profitable team in the National League, if not in baseball, was worth so much more. And so Rickey got Zeckendorf, the builder, to buy, to offer $1 million for his share.
And I think about Zeckendorf. I think about Zeckendorf every time I see the MetLife building, which used to be the Pan Am.
Exactly. And so that was O'Malley's tactical error. And Rickey and O'Malley thought it was a bluff, but he paid that price to buy out Rickey. And Zeckendorf had a finder's fee written in, not a finder's fee, but a tying up of capital fee put into the deal with Rickey, so that if his capital had been tied up and he didn't get the team, he had to be paid $50,000. And that $50,000 went to Ricky when Ricky went to Galbraith in Pittsburgh. Because Galbraith, when you know, you think of the MetLife, Galbraith built the Saucony Tower on 42nd Street. So these were high rollers that, you know, Ricky was involved with. And when he knew he couldn't come back to Brooklyn, he had the Pittsburgh deal to fall into. And that was the beginning of the last 15 years of Ricky's life that weren't as successful as his years in St. Louis and Brooklyn. But I gave it equal treatment in my biography because, you know, Ricky was somebody who never liked to lose and knew how to build organizations. And he succeeded in Pittsburgh, though he wasn't around to enjoy it because he was already trying to start the Continental League when the Pirates won the World Series in 1960. So to close on, you know, how Ricky would see baseball today, one, he'd be very happy that the Pirates are back in the playoffs, conceivably for only one game on Tuesday, this tomorrow. But and he also would be thrilled that baseball is international now. There's so many players from all over the world. As for the salaries of the players and the focus on baseball as entertainment and not baseball, I don't think he'd be too thrilled. But he believed in life. He believed in baseball. And one of the reasons I'm glad I wrote Baseball's Ferocious Gentleman was to bring that kind of passion and intelligence and fun back to life.
Unfortunately, I still have so many more questions, and we don't have as much time left. But when it comes to I'm hearing about the end of the 50s and in terms of the board of directors, right now, as I write the beginning of the series, I'm actually focused a lot on the McKeevers. And there's certain elements that I'm taking because there's so little information about the McKeevers. There's an angle I'm taking with, like, you know, playing just pop culture and television and stuff like that through the McKeevers, because I'm able to write. I don't have as many solidified facts as so many other people when it comes to the Brooklyn Dodgers, like Larry McPhail and Branch Rickey. So with the McKeevers at the end of the 50s, they still had like 25% of I think they owned 25% of the Dodgers till 1975. So they,
well, that's not right. You see, the important thing is that in 45, when that triumvirate of Rickey and Smith and O'Malley were created, all the heirs of the McKeevers, with one exception, and the Abbott's heirs, they were all bought out. There was Mulvey, who married Deary. Mulvey still had a quarter of the team, and he had married Deary McKeever, and that was the last one. And then he kept that quarter in L.A. for a while. I mean, you know, Mulvey is a very important shadowy figure. I mean, he became Bobby Valentine's father-in-law.
And, which is interesting because Ralph Branca married
I meant Ralph Branca's father-in-law.
But I believe Bobby Valentine, I think he's connected to it in terms of the heirs. I think that eventually he married somebody.
Well, we'll have a reprise on this, and I'm glad I was able to help you today.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, again, you know, we have close to about 7 minutes left, so let's end with Branch Rickey and his, you know, getting out of the hospital bed when he, in the early 60s. And getting to the hospital bed and going to the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame to give his last public appearance speech.
Yeah, he the last year in St. Louis, he had been part of the 64 Cardinal front office, but he was asked to resign at the end of the year, which turned out to be a World Series winning year for the Cardinals, the year that the Phillies collapsed. And so at the end of his life, because he could not be idle, he was raising money for his alma mater, Ohio Wesleyan, because, you know, I mentioned St. Louis. When we talk about Ricky, we should always talk about the Ohio-Missouri access before he came to New York, because he was this poor farm boy from southern Ohio who went to Ohio Wesleyan as a conditional student because he had not even graduated from a certified high school in Ohio. And so he's back, he's raising money for his alma mater, but living again in St. Louis, where he raised his six kids, and his wife had taken up painting as a hobby. But he gets ill. He's got all kinds of ailments. He's had the Meniere's disease since the year he signed Robinson to his first contract. He's had heart attacks while he was in Pittsburgh, and he's got 106 fever, and they let him go out to attend the University of Missouri football game against Oklahoma. And that night, November 14th, 1965, he's going to give a speech after he's inducted into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame. George Sisler, his great player, who he converted from pitcher to first base at the University of Michigan and then managed him in St. Louis with the Browns, Sisler's getting inducted that night. So is J.G. Taylor Spink, the publisher of the Sporting News. And Ricky starts talking about courage, and that's his topic, courage, physical and spiritual. And the thing about him, he's Wesley Branch Ricky, Sam. I mean, he's a very religious man. I mean, he's also a very cunning baseball executive, but there were many features to this man, the many faucets running all at once. So he starts talking about a great play that Jim Bottomley, his first Hall of Famer, made in St. Louis when he slid into second, avoiding a tag as the tie-breaking run, even though he had strawberries on his leg and were very painful. But that was the winning run, and he paid the price. Then he says the most courageous man in the Bible is Zacchaeus, who climbed on a tree to hear the words of Jesus Christ. And he describes Zacchaeus like he would describe you or me if he met you, you know, in physical terms. You know, he was a tax collector. He was not liked in town. He wore fancy suits and boss shirts, but he did believe in this gospel of Jesus Christ. So he climbed a tree. He went out on a limb, which is where the term comes from in the Bible, in the book of Luke. And I want to talk to you about him. And then he has his fatal heart attack, and he says, I can't go on anymore. And he collapses and will never regain consciousness. He'll stay in a hospital in Columbia, Missouri, where he was speaking for almost a month, but never regained consciousness, and died on December 9th, 1965. And at the time, it was a front-page item, but his influence in baseball had faded. You know, he did not get really credit for the Pirate victory. The Continental League had never got off the ground, although it did provide the Mets, your team, and the Colt 45s and the expansion of the American League. But he was very disappointed in that because he didn't like 10-team leagues, because he was old enough to remember the 10-team National League of the 1890s. So, I mean, that's my fascination for him, because he covered so much baseball history in his lifetime, but he also made his history. And so at the time, this was the beginning of the Black Power movement. It was also Vietnam, war rebellions going on all over the country. And you know, he fell into eclipse, but slowly, beginning in the 80s, with the musical The First on Broadway, in which, by the way, David Alan Greer, who's now quite a successful black actor and writer and performer, he played Jackie Robinson. he becomes a little more known. And then in the 90s, when we start memorializing Jackie's first year of 47, he becomes more known. And then, you know, I think Harrison Ford has maybe done the best job in bringing back to life on film what an amazing character and essentially good Christian Branch, Wesley Branch, Ricky was.
Branch, sorry, Lee, unfortunately we're going to get cut off.